Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 240, and we're going to take a break here and talk about what's going on with Built to Go, what's coming in the future, and what crazy projects I'm working on. We're also going to talk about a very big piece of news involving national parks in the United States and what different kind of washer fluids actually are washer fluids and an idea for what to do on Christmas. Except it is Christmas, so it's too late. Well, it's not too late. If you happen to be hearing this on Christmas Day and you're wondering, what the heck am I going to do? I have an idea for you at the end. But yeah, folks, I bet you thought I was going to skip Christmas and not do an episode today. But in fact, I am doing an episode today because I'm in the mood to do an episode, and so here we are. But it's going to be a little bit of a different kind of episode because I'm just going to use today to catch you up on some things that are going on. And it'll be a normal episode, but there's actually a lot going on right now. So let me talk about that. First, I have built a glossary of sorts. So this podcast is episode 240. We've probably had 245 episodes, if you count the bonus episodes. There's been a lot, and I have introduced a lot of terminology, some of it van life specific, some of it Built to Go specific, and I realize that new people might be lost. Like when I say things like B2B charger, or I say Tiki Bago Land, or Hook Waka Bang, or something like that, new folks have no idea what I'm talking about. And even though I try to put in there, you know, Tiki Bago Land is this piece of land we own that we park our RVs on, that kind of thing, it doesn't always make sense to people. So I've simply created, it's essentially a spreadsheet of over 200 van life terms that apply not only just to this podcast, but also to van life in general. So if you hear people throwing around terms and you don't know what they are, you can go to this glossary and it'll give you a very brief explanation as to what it is. Now, I know there are wikis out there. Nomad Wiki is great. There's a couple of others. That's all fine and good, but sometimes it's a little bit of effort to go to a wiki to just find out what a term means. I wanted something very simple. Also, you can print this, you can save it, you don't need the internet to use it if you don't want to, you can copy it, you can do whatever the heck you want with it. I am going to release this into the public domain, but it is a work in progress, and I need your help with it, because I know what words I think are jargon that need to be explained, but you probably have a totally different list, and I want your list. If you'd like to help out with the glossary, you can go to the glossary itself, and there's a link at the very top where you can submit terms, and then I will add them after I vet them and make sure they're not duplicates or jokes or anything like that. But how do you get to this glossary? Well, it is currently linked to the top of the website at builttogo.com. It's right up there. And I did make a URL for it that's fairly easy to remember, but people, I don't know, do people remember URLs anymore? I mean, the world has moved on from that, just like people don't remember phone numbers anymore. But the URL for it is bit.ly, which is bit.ly/all caps btg-no caps glossary. See, even a simple URL is complicated. So it's bit.ly/btg-glossary. I don't expect anybody to remember that. That's mostly for my use. Best thing to do is either go to the show notes or go to the Built to Go website and find the link at the top. Actually, there's links to a bunch of stuff up there. So if you're curious about Built to Go stuff, check the links up there. Now, why did I create this glossary? I mean, I like the idea to begin with. It's something I've toyed with. But I specifically created this glossary, and I'm hesitating to announce this because it seems like a lot of people announce things like this and then they never happen. But I'm committing to you that I'm going to write a book about van life. And before you roll your, oh, I know I'm too late. You've already rolled your eyes. Let's take a step back here. I know there's a ton of people who do van life and then they have to write their how to do van life book that is basically a copy of everybody else's How to Do Van Life book. Sure, there are differences, of course, but it's like, you need a battery, and you know, that is not what I'm writing. My book is going to be less about how to do van life, because we have a whole podcast for that. I'm going to write a book about why to do van life. My goal with this book is to help people who are curious about van life See if it's right for them. That's it. And basically, it's a book for the curious. If you're curious about van life, I would like you to read this book. I hope to have it done by March. That is my deadline. And I will probably ask some folks to take a look at it and offer comments and edits and stuff like that. And then this is, folks, this is not going to be a New York Times bestseller. I'm just going to self-publish this. I want to go through the process and learn about what it takes to write books and all that. And this is my project to do that with. But I will probably offer it as a premium for folks who are willing to donate to the show and whatever. Anyway, this is all an experiment, like almost everything I do. But I am working on that, and I'm committing to it. I am committing to you, dear listener, that there will be a book available. And yes, I will make an audiobook version of it as well. So more details on that to come as it develops. I will also share with you the process I went through to create this book in case you would like to write your own book. And again, this is going to be self-published. I don't know how to get a publisher, and I don't know that I actually want a publisher, so I'm just going to go through the self-publishing thing and see what happens. That said, I'm also going to make another commitment to you. I am going to commit to carrying this podcast up to episode 300. So we're at 240 now. That means 60 more episodes, which is over a year's worth of episodes. So there's a whole other year of Built2Go coming at least. After that, I'm reserving the right to either end the podcast, pass the torch to somebody else, and I have a plan for that that might work, or just keep going if I feel like it. Because, folks, everything has to come to an end. And I actually learned this trick from Penn and Teller, believe it or not. So when Penn and Teller, the magicians, got together, they did not want to become the Beatles, meaning they didn't want to get more and more success and then let infighting destroy everything they'd built. So they made a commitment to each other that they will keep performing until a certain date. And that's the level of their commitment. That's it. Once they reach that date, the commitment is over, and they can do whatever they want. Now, I know for a fact that they reached that date and passed it, and they created a new commitment. But I thought that was a great way to do it. See, there are times when doing the podcast is more work than others. There are times when I'm busy or I don't feel well and I don't feel like doing it. But a commitment makes me do it. So there's my commitment to you. 300 episodes. Right now, at episode 240, I expect to keep going well beyond 300. But as I'm about to discuss, there's a lot of changes coming, and who knows what's going to happen. So, at any rate, I'm committing to you up to episode 300, unless something terrible happens or whatever. You know, if the world ends, sorry, you don't get episode 300. If my house burns down, whatever. You know, you get it. Speaking of terrible things, this isn't that terrible. I have to go in for some surgery. Now, hold up. This is not a major deal. I have a wonky ankle. I have an ankle injury. It's called an OCD. It stands for osteochondritis dissecans, which is a fancy way of saying that, to the best of my knowledge, I have a bit of damaged cartilage that has ossified, that is, or calcified, or basically it's turned into bone, and it's interfering with the way my ankle works. This is not a huge deal, except that it means that I can't walk. I can walk, I can get around, but I can't do trips like I've been doing. My recent trip to Danube, where I was walking all over Europe every day on cobblestones, really made things worse. And I've talked with my doctor, and they decided that surgery is necessary. All that said, what does that mean for the podcast? Well, heck, they could cut the whole foot off, and I can still do the podcast, so that's not an issue. The issue is I might need to take a week or two off because I'm under some medication or something. And my biggest concern is that it's going to interfere with VanFest. Now, I have committed to doing VanFest USA February 6th through 9th. You can look it up on the website, vanfestusa.com. And I really want to go because I have some other things I want to do there, too. I mean, I really want to go. But finding a surgical window is difficult in Chicago, and it's basically a six-week recovery. And one of the things they've already told me is, you can't drive. This is not happy news. Not only do I not have a passport right now because I had to renew it, and when you renew your passport, you lose your old one, but then I can't drive. And I'm like, who am I if I'm a person without a passport who can't drive? This is not the me I recognize. But it's all temporary. So I'm really hoping it doesn't interfere with those dates, but I will let you guys know, because I know some of you hope to meet me there, and yeah, that may not happen. So yeah, again, this is not a major surgery. You know, there's no need for concern. It's arthroscopic. They drill a little hole in your foot and stick a camera in there with some snippers on it or something like that. I'm not at all worried about the medical part of it. I'm worried about the timing part of it. So hopefully that won't impact things too much. Also, I have been struggling in my head back and forth about what to do about the truck. So to back up for people who may not be aware, I have collected, in my opinion, way too many vehicles. I have an ambulance conversion that is my primary camper van. It's a 144 Sprinter 2011. Talked about it endlessly. I have a Scamp, a 13-foot Scamp, which is one of those fiberglass egg trailers. I have the Tiki Bago, the 1973 Winnebago Indian that's been converted into a tiki shack. And my wife and I just bought this massive Airstream, this 26-foot Airstream, which is not van life. I mean, it is. It depends on how you use it. But definitely getting more into the glamping end of things with this. But I also have this truck. And my situation now is that I live in Chicago. I have the truck parked in Chicago. And I don't have my van. My van's 90 minutes away at least. And I feel lost without it. So I keep thinking, well, the truck is much more practical for many things. So that's the vehicle I should have as my daily driver. But it's not a camper. So I am going to turn it into a camper. But I keep going back and forth on how much to do. Should I build it out as my primary rig and maybe get rid of the van and a few other things? Or should I just do a no build in it and just have it be something I can use but not my primary vehicle? So if I'm going to like spend an overnight somewhere while I'm driving there, I can take the truck. But if I'm going to do an actual trip, I would take the van. And I think that is actually the most reasonable thing. So I have a topper that I got for it. I got on Facebook Marketplace. It was $250. I don't know how old this topper is, but it does not have a third eye in it. So it could be very, very old. The company that made it is long out of business. But it's a nice size. I've got an 8-foot bed, and the topper is a high-rise topper made by Eagle, who, again, doesn't exist. I think I could make a pretty comfortable space in there. And I actually started buying stuff for it, and we'll talk about that at the product review. So I will talk more about that too. Again, if you are new to this, my philosophy on van life is that van life is a big, 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 big tent. You don't have to have a van or a specific kind of van. To me, van life is anybody who is living and traveling in vehicles, and they're using those vehicles as a home, whether it be permanent or temporary. That's where I'm coming from. It also can be a school bus, it can be a smart car, it can be a trailer. I don't care what it is. You're doing van life if you wish to think that you're doing van life, in my opinion. And I'm very conscious that van life is getting expensive. Vehicles are more expensive, and it's harder to find places to park. There are a lot of challenges right now. And I thought, what is one of the simplest, easiest ways that you can have a reliable vehicle? And one way is a minivan. I will talk up minivans forever. I think they're a great choice. But the truck cap, again, pickup truck. You need to have a pickup truck, okay? You can find these truck caps on Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist, whatever, for really cheap. And then you've got a very capable vehicle with a nice amount of living space back there. And if you do it as a no build, which is a build where you're not modifying the vehicle heavily, then you still got a truck too. So I'm intrigued by this idea, and I will be talking more about it as we go on. And I definitely think for folks who are towing an RV, where you have a truck anyway, why not make the truck also sleepable? I mean, I can think of lots of cases where you tow your trailer, park your trailer, but then you're going to go pretty far from your trailer and maybe want to take a nap or cook or spend the night while you're traveling. Why not make the back of your truck into a camper too? So anyway, obviously I'm thinking about that a lot because I'm talking about it a lot, but we will have more about that. So folks, that is the built-to-go news for the end of 2024 here. We have one more episode this year, and then we're off on a whole new adventure as the whole world changes and things may get crazy, or maybe not. We shall see. Thanks to everyone who listens to this podcast. I make this podcast for you. Every time someone listens, it makes me feel good. It makes me feel especially good if folks write to me or say, hey, thanks for doing that podcast. Or they say, hey, you screwed this up. Fix it. I like that too. So if you're in either one of those camps and you wish to drop me a line, go ahead and send an email to jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. I especially like content suggestions, which I will try to do. And I especially like corrections, but I'm also very fond of, hey, thanks. It's always a good little note to receive. Van Life News. Just one news item, and it's a big one. I mean, I'm very excited about this anyway. Let me introduce some letters and numbers to you. That is HR 6492. That is not a password. It is not some secret code. It stands for House Resolution 6492. It is a bill that has passed Congress and is expected to be signed by President Biden. Although, as far as I can tell, it has not been yet, which I'm a little concerned about. But this act has major implications for van dwellers, travelers, campers who are using national parks in the United States. They've changed a lot of the rules, and it looks like they're pretty favorable to us. So, before I get into this, I want to introduce you to RVMiles.com, RVMiles.com, just like it sounds. This is an RV podcast, YouTube channel, and website. And I actually thought the guy's name was Miles, but his name is Jason Epperson. He is excellent at what he does, which is to provide all the news in the RV world that you could ever want. So I watch his stuff, and it's RV, not van life. There are overlaps. It's not necessarily the same. I get that. He doesn't talk very much about van life in general, but he does talk about things that impact both those worlds, and this is one of those things. So I will have a link in the show notes to this particular article that I've been looking at. But basically, you can film in national parks now. So if you weren't aware, if you had a monetized YouTube channel and you took video in a national park without a permit, that was a major, major problem. Like, they would come after you. And there are major fines being levied against people who were doing that. Seems crazy, right? And then it got so crazy that there were some rules that you couldn't take photographs. I mean, it's just not modern. And I understand the concerns. They want to protect the national parks. They don't want big movie studios coming in and taking over the park for the day. That's fine. But they have a new rule that is in this bill, if it gets signed, that says you do not need a permit for filming on public lands as long as, I'm going to read the quote here, as long as that filming is merely incidental to or documenting an activity or event that is allowed or authorized at the system unit. I don't know what that means. I don't know what a system unit is, but we're going to assume that it means public lands in this case. Legalese is always so much fun. And that is whether any individual receives compensation or not. It doesn't matter. So the trick is, if you have 5 people or fewer, you can film and photograph to your heart's content and not worry about it. Now, what if you have 6 people or 8 people? This bill requires that there be a permitting process that is free and automatic approval. You basically just have to go on a website and say, hey, I've got 8 people. We're going to film wedding photos or whatever you happen to be doing. We're going to make a YouTube video, whatever. And that's it. And then you'll be able to do it. I think this is very, very exciting. I think this is definitely where we should be. I thought these rules were quite draconian. Now, there's no mention of drones here. I imagine the drone thing is still going to be, you're not going to be able to do that. That's for a lot of reasons. Drones affect wildlife. Drones make noise and can disturb people. And sad to say, people really hate drones. They just hate them. So anytime there's a place where people are flying drones, there's going to be drama, and that would cause more park resources to be needed. And, well, that's a problem, because the parks are really suffering for resources. But this bill helps with that, too. Some of the other things it's supposed to do is increase Wi-Fi and broadband and cellular access in all the campground facilities. It's supposed to establish new campgrounds. And it's supposed to establish rock climbing areas where the government will be putting in your anchors and maintaining them. And that's a pretty good thing, because then you will have an agency who's actually responsible for making sure these anchors are in good shape, rather than just some folks who go out and hammer loops in rocks and, you know, maybe they don't know what they're doing, you know, etc. So that is also a good thing. They're going to provide more mapping. They're going to allow more vehicles in certain places, and they're going to kind of control that more. And they're also going to partner with third parties to help manage some of these campgrounds, which not everybody's excited about. You go to a campground, and maybe it's going to be managed by KOA, and that probably will mean increased prices, but it should also mean better services. So we'll see how that turns out. They've also dedicated money and support to businesses just outside the park. So there should be better gas stations, better food, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, I think it's all good. And this doesn't just impact national parks. It's also for the Forest Service, BLM land, the Army Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife. It's basically all these public lands groups are required to follow what's in this bill. It's a pretty big bill. There's a lot of stuff in there. And and if you're a biker, they're going to create 10 new long-distance bike trails across the country. They each have to be 80 miles at least. So these are brand new trails. They're not going to like blaze trails here. They're going to use old roads and maybe rails. I don't know what they're going to do, but they're not going to damage the environment to create these, but they're going to establish them, and that means they will maintain them. So that's a good thing. Another thing I thought was interesting is they're going to add target shooting ranges near each national forest and BLM district. And I suppose this means they're going to enforce firearm laws more because people like to take their guns out in the desert and shoot things. And sometimes they damage things. I know Saguaro National Park has a problem with people shooting the saguaros, and those things take 1,000 years to grow. So I think their solution is that we're going to give people a place to shoot, and then hopefully they will be enforcing that better since they have a place for people to go. So I don't know. We'll see how that goes. I highly recommend that you read the article at rvmiles.com. The name of the article is, again, click on the link. Don't try to remember the URL. But the name of the article is Sweeping Public Lands Bill Passes Congress. Explore Act Goes to Biden for Signature. And yes, that's the name of this. It is the Explore Act. I think it's a great thing. I think it could impact us a lot. So pay attention to that. Hopefully Biden will sign it. He just signed a whole raft of bills, 50 of them, and I couldn't find this one in that raft. So, I don't know. We'll see. But I expect that he will sign it. Tech Talk. So, washer fluids. Have you noticed that there are a lot of them now? I mean, it used to be washer fluid was washer fluid was washer fluid. It was blue. It didn't matter which one you got. It was all the same. And now there's all these differences, and they come in different colors. And what does it all mean? So I did some research into all these different washer fluids, and it is the time of year where washer fluid is super important. I highly recommend that if you're driving long distances in the winter, that you have an extra bottle of washer fluid. Not only because if you, under certain road conditions, you will go through a lot of washer fluid keeping your windshield clean, but also because it's useful. You can use it to winterize things so that they don't freeze, so long as it's nothing you're going to eat or drink from. For example, if you have a drain, and let's say your water's winterized, but you have a drain and you pour something down the drain, if you chase that with some windshield washer fluid, that will protect your drain from freezing. You can also flush toilets with windshield washer fluid, even if you don't have water. So it's good stuff to have. But what is it? What kind should you get? Why is this one $2 and this one $8? What's the difference? So, normal washer fluid is simply water and methanol. Methanol is the kind of alcohol you can't drink. It's wood alcohol. If you drink it, you go blind and die. It's a bad thing. Don't drink it. But it doesn't freeze. Now, there's summer blend and winter blend sometimes. And basically, the upshot of this whole thing is most of these names just are how much alcohol is in it. More alcohol in there means it costs more, and it also means it will freeze at lower temperatures. So summer blend might freeze at zero. Winter blend, usually negative 30 or negative 40. So that's all that means. If you want to make an actual comparison, take a look at the alcohol content, which should be listed on the bottle. That's all that matters. In the summer, you can actually just use water. It'll work almost as well. The problem is that in July, you fill up your thing and you only use half of it, and then December comes and then it freezes. So I don't recommend you use water. I recommend you always use actual windshield washer fluid. But you don't necessarily have to get the super cold stuff unless you live like in Fairbanks or something where super cold is a common thing. What about de-icer windshield washer fluid? That's a new thing. And the idea is that you would fill your windshield washer fluid with this de-icer stuff and then spray the windshield, and it would help get the ice off the windshield. Yeah, I looked at it. It's mostly just stuff with more alcohol in it, and the alcohol is supposed to help break up the ice. I wouldn't buy that. It's expensive, and you're better off with an ice scraper, honestly. It's not going to help that much. You're still going to be using the ice scraper. Just use it to begin with and save the money on the windshield washer fluid. What about the Rain-X stuff? Now, that stuff is different. It's usually orange, which I feel like all vehicle fluids should be color-coded by what fluid they are. I once saw windshield washer fluid that was bright green, and it looked like antifreeze, and that just seemed stupid to me, but whatever. There's purple and green. There's all different colors now. I think it's dumb, but that's what we've got. But the Rain-X stuff is different. It is not just normal washer fluid. It has a silicone polymer in it that coats your windshield and makes your windshield hydrophobic. That doesn't mean it has rabies. That means that water will bead up and roll off of it. And if you use that stuff over time, you'll end up with this coating of silicone polymer on your windshield, and it will actually help shed rain, and theoretically that helps your wipers last longer too. I have used this stuff. It does cost more, but it does seem to work. I don't think it's a terrible thing. If you're going to be driving through very buggy areas, it can definitely help. You will also see the bug stuff. There's Bug X washer fluid. It's the same stuff. It basically makes it so nothing sticks to your windshield. So just buy whatever's cheapest. Now, there's something you may not have heard of, and I haven't seen these for a while, but there's such a thing as a windshield washer fluid heater. And the idea is that it will heat up your washer fluid so you're spraying your windshield with hot water. That works really, really well. Obviously, you're going to have to start the vehicle and run it for a while until you get the stuff hot. But hot water will definitely work better than cold water or anything. But hitting a very, very cold windshield with a warm liquid is probably not a great idea. There is a chance that on very, very cold days, you could crack your windshield using this. So that may be why I haven't seen them for a while. They were definitely a thing in the 80s. I haven't seen them. And, you know, you got to hook up something else electrical under the hood. It's something else that can confuse mechanics, and there's more chances for short. Anyway, I'm not sure they're a great idea, but that's a thing that exists. I kind of wish cars would simply run a radiator hose through the windshield washer fluid receptacle and automatically heat it with free heat. Doesn't that sound like something that makes sense? I bet there are some high-end vehicles that do that, but none of the ones I've ever owned. Product review. So when I'm looking at my no-build stuff, I'm making a wish list on Amazon, right? And I'm like, oh, this might work, put it in the wish list. But, you know, it's a good idea to do. You just make the wish list on Amazon. You can make it private, whatever. Doesn't mean you're asking people to buy these things for you. It just saves them all. And then later when you're ready to buy, you can go look and see and check prices and all that. Okay, so I'm doing that. So I need a place to sleep in the back of my truck, and I'm a little bit taller than average. I'm 6 feet tall, so I'm very concerned about having a bed that I can sit on and not hit my head on the ceiling. So I have to make a bed that's fairly low to the ground. And yes, I could build one, or I could do the IKEA thing that I like to do so much, but this is a no-build, and I want it to be very flexible. I want this thing to be able to be emptied in 10 minutes. That's my goal. So some kind of a cot that could just be pulled out would be perfect. And I saw one at REI, which is an expensive place to buy good stuff. It's quality stuff, but it's very expensive. It was $200, but it looked like kind of what I wanted. It was almost like a lounge chair, but it would fold flat into a bed and had these big pads on the bottom for the feet. I thought it would work well, but I didn't want to spend $200. And I found one on Amazon that's kind of a knockoff. It's a Timber Ridge, which is another brand. You can tell that they're doing the same thing with this. I mean, it looks very similar. But for some reason, this one color, which is kind of a blue and gray, was only $79, and it had a $12 coupon. So it's a bargain, in my opinion. I mean, these chairs cost a lot to begin with. This thing, you can absolutely sleep on it. It's much wider than a camping chair. You know, this thing is definitely meant to be a bed, but it can also have the back fold up and the feet drop down. And I'm thinking in my van build, my NV200 that I built earlier, this might have been a better solution than the bed I actually did use, especially because you can fold it up and take it out, and then you have all that space, or you can fold it up during the day and just put it against the wall. I don't know. This thing has some potential. So it is meant to be folded up and put away. It has Velcro straps that will keep it all together, and it is pretty comfortable. Now, Is it super comfortable? Is it as comfortable as the bed in your house? Probably not. But it does support camping pads. You can put camping pads on it. You could put a camping pad down or even just a piece of foam and then put a sheet on that. And you would have something that was pretty close to a bed. The way the legs are is interesting. There's a leg right where your head goes, and then there's a leg almost to the middle, and then there's a leg like halfway to your feet. By your feet, though, there's no support at all. So if you sit on that end, you're going to hit the ground. The thing's going to flip up in the air. So if you were in, say, a minivan, and you put this thing down in bed mode, you couldn't sit on the end that had the feet. So I would recommend you put that against a wall or something, because you can sit on the other end. Anyway, I think it's a bargain. The other colors are $165. For some reason, this one is cheap, and I bought it, and it came in 2 days, and I've been messing around with it, and I like it. It supports 600 pounds, but it only weighs 20 pounds. If you're curious about dimensions, it's 79 inches long, which is 6'7", and it's 30 inches wide, and it's only a little over 10 inches off the ground. So, yeah. If you are looking for something to sleep on that doesn't take up too much space, that would work great in a minivan or an SUV or in a pickup truck, yeah, this Timber Ridge camping cot is definitely something to look at. I'll have a link in the show notes. I don't know how long this price is going to last or this coupon, but it's $79.99 with a $12 coupon, and I think it is a bargain. And it has free return. If you just want to take a chance and get it and maybe return it, that is totally fine too. So, I like it. I'm going to use it. Tales from the Road. Continuing the theme of strange things I've eaten around the world. When I was a kid, I was 10. I was 11. But I was, you know, a young man, an old kid, not quite a teenager. But my parents decided, hey, let's go to Peru. Now, this was at a time when very few Americans were going to Peru. I think that year, fewer than 8,000 Americans visited Peru, which was 1978, because there was a terrorist uprising called the Shining Path, which, oddly, James Randi knew some of those people. There's a whole thing there that I don't understand, but that was a weird path crossing that we have. I did not meet any of the Shining Path folks. I just did touristy stuff. But we went down to Lima, which is the capital of Peru, big city, and did stuff there. But of course, if you're going to go to Peru, you're going to go to Machu Picchu. So we went to Machu Picchu, which is a fascinating place to go. You fly to Cuzco, and then you take a train up, and do all these switchbacks and everything. And when I did it back then, the place was empty. I was in Machu Picchu with maybe 100 other people, whereas if you go today, it could be 10,000 other people. I didn't do the big hike up the stairs or anything. That wasn't really an option. What you would do is the train would get to the base of the mountain, and then you would ride up what's called the Urubamba Highway, because that's the name of the river, and that's the name of the guy, the European, who discovered Machu Picchu. And you'd spiral around and go up there on this cliff road with no barriers. Anyway, I could tell a lot of stories about Machu Picchu, but the one I want to tell you is about after we went to Machu Picchu, went back to our hotel in Cuzco, after I had a whole day of altitude sickness, because Cuzco's at like 13,000 feet. If you are an altitude-challenged person, you will be challenged in Cuzco. Take my word for it. But we had to eat. Now, this is 1978. Nobody in Cuzco spoke English. We didn't speak Spanish. But we found a restaurant, and they gave us the menus, and we had to find something to eat. Now, I was a picky eater. I had a hard time eating anyway. But with this menu in Spanish, I couldn't pick anything out, so I just turned it over to my parents and said, hey, I would like some food, please. And so they're looking down the menu, and they're like, polo, that means chicken, right? Polo. Yes, I know it's pollo. And then they're like, oh, what is patata? I think that's potato. So chicken and potatoes. You like chicken and potatoes, let's get that. And I'm like, yeah, chicken and potatoes sounds okay. So they order this, I don't know what it was, but what I get is a bowl filled with a liquid with an entire whole potato floating in it, although the liquid wasn't deep enough for it to float, so it kind of just stuck up out of the middle like a volcanic island. Bon appétit. That was my dinner. I don't know what it was. I poked around at it. I couldn't find anything that looked like chicken. It was just this big boiled potato in this brown liquid that I guess was soup. Could have been sauce. I don't know. So I'm poking at it with a fork, and I'm like, maybe I should try a spoon. And then I ate about half of it, and yeah, that was my dinner in Cuzco. And, you know, the thing is, perspective-wise, I would love to go back to that restaurant today. I'm sure it's long gone. I'm sure things have been touristified beyond the ability of this tiny little Peruvian restaurant run probably by a local family serving tourists from all over the world what they eat themselves. I would love to go back to that place. But as a kid, I just wanted a freaking hamburger, and I couldn't have one. So, you know, I always say that you travel through distance and you travel through time, and you can undo the distance, but you can't undo the time. So there is something that I did that I don't think anybody can duplicate, because it was 40-something years ago, and I'm sure that's gone. But apparently, Peruvians at one time ate whole potatoes sitting in some kind of a liquid. I will never know what it was. A place to visit. Hey, it's Christmas Day, and not everybody has family on Christmas Day, or their family's not available. When I was a kid, my folks both worked the night shift. My mother was a nurse, and she worked from 3 to 11. She had second shift, and my dad drove truck for the Boston Globe, and he went to work at like 11 or 2. It changed. So basically, the night before Christmas, Christmas Eve, they were working. And that meant they slept during Christmas. We would typically do our family Christmas stuff either on New Year's Eve, if that could be arranged, or then late in the day in Christmas. But Christmas morning, nothing to do. I was an only child, no brothers and sisters. Parents are in bed asleep, and I'm just like wondering what to do. And I had a friend who was in a similar situation. They would do their Christmas and be done with it all by 9, and then he would be bored all day. And what we figured out was that while everything's closed on Christmas Day, there's one place that isn't, and it was the bowling alley. Yeah, for some reason, the bowling alley was open on Christmas Day, so that was became our tradition. Every morning, he'd come over at 10, and we'd walk down through Salem into Peabody, which most people would say Peabody, but the correct pronunciation is Peabody, to a place called Metro Bowl, which was right there in Peabody Square. And in fact, it still is. I know someone who lives near there, and they say, yep, Metro Bowl is still there. And we would go candlepin bowling. Metro Bowl was this huge bowling alley. They had something like 75 lanes. And in Massachusetts, it was all candlepin. We didn't know of any place that had what we called big ball bowling, which you would probably call 10-pin. That wasn't a thing. Everything was little round balls and thin pins, and you would bowl 3 balls, not 2. But that was our thing. We'd go and do a few strings, and then there were some pool tables and an arcade attached to it, and they had a little snack bar. And that was our yearly Christmas tradition. Not with family, just with a couple of folks, a couple of guys. We were, you know, kind of the outcasts. Yeah, we were not the popular people in school by any means. But we would go and bowl, and that would be our Christmas. And, you know, it was kind of nice. So if you find yourself this Christmas looking for something to do and you don't know where you can go, check the bowling alley. There may be a historic reason for why the bowling alley is open on Christmas. Because it used to be illegal for bowling, to do any kind of bowling. There weren't any bowling alleys, just like bowling you set up in your backyard was illegal except on Christmas Day, believe it or not. So in England in the 16th century, workers were prohibited from bowling except on Christmas. It was a law in 1541, and it lasted for 300 years. It wasn't repealed until 1845. So bowling on Christmas is definitely a thing. And if you find yourself out on the road in your van and you're looking for something to do, find yourself a bowling alley. Hopefully it'll be open, and throw that ball for all it's worth. Resource recommendation. This is a dual resource, and it's one that I think is important for a lot of van life folks for two reasons. The first off, it is a way to find a local food bank or food pantry. If you need some food, this might be able to help you out. And it's organized by Feeding America. They're a great organization, and basically it's a website where you can type in your zip code, and it will tell you all the options you have. But food banks serve two purposes. First off, they feed people, obviously. Second off, they give people a way to volunteer. If you are somebody who has problems with loneliness or you simply want to give back because maybe you needed a food bank back in the day and now you don't, food banks are always looking for volunteers. Always, always, always. So this link I'm about to share with you has two things going on for it. Number one, it lets you find a place to get food. And number two, it lets you find a place to volunteer. And it is feedingamerica.org/findyourlocalfoodbank with hyphens in between the words. So feedingamerica.org, find your local food bank. I highly recommend you check that out if you're interested in that. You may be asking, but why didn't you mention donating food? Well, I have volunteered at food banks, a few different ones. I can tell you that donating food, while it's better than wasting food, is not as good as donating money. If you want to donate to a food bank, never, never, never go to the grocery store and buy food to donate. Because if you, say, bought $50 worth of food, you would pay taxes on it and you would give them what you can get for $50. But if you give them $50, they don't pay taxes, they have discounts, there's all kinds of ways they can turn that $50 into $65, $75, or $100. So your $50 will do a lot more good if you give it directly to the food bank rather than the food itself. So just a little tip that I think is useful. It feels good to give, and you might think it feels better to give like a can of soup rather than the money the can of soup costs, but the money is better, easier, and does more good. So check it out. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 240. I hope you're having a very happy holiday, however you choose to celebrate it. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you're curious about where to find Built2Go stuff, visit built2go.com. It's all there at the top of the screen for you. Let me know if you can't find anything. Until next time, remember the words of Amelia Barr, who said, "Kindness is always fashionable and always welcome."